Your security system should not be based on what the government is telling you to do. Your security system should be based on not getting robbed. And we are seeing in mature markets loss that is substantial. And I don't care if you're insured, because insurance doesn't cover the headache. Insurance doesn't cover your time dealing with the insurance. Insurance may not even make you whole. When you think about how small a vape cartridge is and how valuable it is and how easily you could liquidate that on the secondary market, these are high value products. And so thinking about security, and frankly, whatever that you're required to do for security, do more. Do more. It'll help you sleep at night.
Welcome to How to Flourish in Cannabis. I'm your host, Brian Weber. How to Flourish in Cannabis is a bi-weekly educational-focused show with experienced leaders in regulated cannabis. Our guests have a wide range of industry experience: lawyers, accountants, growers. Today, our guest is a 20-year veteran of cannabis real estate. Our guests are asked to give general educational knowledge in the subject matter that they are experts in. No hidden pitches here. This is designed to be a masterclass in regulated cannabis. Many operators fail for lack of proper education and guidance in operating a highly regulated, capital-intensive business. How to Flourish in Cannabis is our effort to elevate and educate. Today's show I'm really excited about. It's Cannabis Real Estate in 2024, Best Practices, Mistakes, and Trends. Our guest today is Yaro Kerbrin. He's a 39-year veteran of cannabis industry in California, a second-generation cannabis cultivator. He has experience in legacy, medical, and regulated markets. He has current and former committee leadership positions with national, state, and local trade and advocacy organizations, including the NCIA, CCIA, amongst others. Yaro is a verified social equity in San Francisco and Sonoma County. Yaro has been in real estate as a financier for over 20 years, a licensed realtor for the past decade, and the past 7 years as a land use and zoning consultant. Currently, he's a director of business development at Zone Properties and contributed to Hyatt Nine News. He was a director of real estate for CanDev, acquiring the real estate for 15% of the retail dispensaries in Ohio. In his work at Special Teams Consulting, he focuses on cannabis real estate, due diligence, infrastructure evaluations, and acquisition and disposition of considerations. Yaro, thank you for joining us today.
Great to be here. Thank you, Brian. It's really an honor.
Especially here in New Jersey and New York, land is such land that is usable for cannabis operations is such a valuable commodity. There's so many questions about it, and it's the same all over the country as well. But especially, you know, in my networking experience here, I really wanted to have you on today just to give some elements of truth in what is a usable cannabis property and how to filter that out before wasting time, money, energy, resources on harping down the roads for the long one. So today's topic, just to reiterate, cannabis real estate in 2024, best practices, mistakes, and trends. So Yaro, let's kick it off. I know the first one was so riveting, but so important. What's our first point?
First point is zoning and setbacks. And look, I know that what I do is the boring part of the industry. It's never going to be sexy. It isn't culture. It's not genetics. It's only appreciated when somebody has a horror story or they're able to avoid a horror story. And so I would say that the three legs of the boring stool are real estate, insurance, and maybe like security considerations. So, you know, it's like oxygen. You only notice when it's not there, right?
That's very fair.
Zoning and setbacks. And so when I look at the way in which entrepreneurs and investors and teams run at standing up regulated cannabis businesses, the first thing that I always think needs to be the first criteria, the first filter, the first lens is zoning and setbacks. Zoning is to a property like DNA is to an organism. It lets you know what the highest and best use for that property can be. And zoning and setbacks is where a property decision starts. And a property decision should start before a business is built, because a business is limited by where it's venued. And so the thing that comes to mind for me for zoning and setbacks is the uninformed choices regarding siting. And so Zoning setbacks and permits already issued in a municipality are critical first go, non-go, green flag, red flag decisions as someone goes to stand up a cannabis business. And so zoning will let you know what can be done. Setbacks are typically from sensitive uses.
Describe to me what setbacks are. When I hear setbacks, and I know we were first talking about this, and I'm like, how far you need to be back from the road? I'm assuming that's not the case, though.
A setback is not like when your girlfriend broke up with you and you were depressed. A setback has to do with the distance from a sensitive use that might otherwise preclude a property from being able to be used for a cannabis business. A great example of that would be a school or a church. And so many municipalities have a setback distance. And the first thing you need to do when you think about whether a property is going to work is you need to know those setbacks. You also need to know whether those setbacks are measured from the property line or the middle of the property. And so people can save a lot of time and energy if they pay attention to that first. And then permits. Sometimes with certain permits, there's only X number of permits being issued in a certain municipality. So you may find a property that qualifies based on setbacks and zoning. But if they've already issued the total allocation of a particular permit, there's no point in running at it.
Are a lot of those setbacks set at the local level? Like I know here I live in Jersey City, like there was a certain distance from another cannabis dispensary. And obviously there's some school ones that were in there, but like other dispensaries or other, you know, it's a more urban environment here, no cultivation centers. But yeah, there was a setback related toward other dispensaries as well.
Yeah. So those are often set at both a state and local level. Some states allow local municipalities to make their policies more restrictive. And now we're seeing certain states where they're saying local municipalities can be less restrictive, but not more restrictive. And so if you don't have a good compliance person, if you don't have somebody who's really well-versed in this, the chances that you're going to waste a lot of time and money are very high.
How can an operator get into, you know, a property with some confidence before doing a lot of legwork and, you know, potentially exhausting a real estate professional on this? What are some things that they can look for to like narrow this down and you know, without actually leaving, hopefully without leaving their desk?
Well, so like the companies that I've worked for the last couple of years take a lot of that site selection uncertainty out of the process, and then they landlord to operators. However, my suggestion for people who are not in that arrangement would be to use a local zoning expert, a land use consultant. They do not need to be cannabis specific. And then the other way you can add some certainty to the exercise is by getting what's called a ZVL or a zoning verification letter from a local municipalities. That can also increase the level of certainty.
Is that like just reaching out to the government being like, I'm looking for this zoning verification letter?
Yeah. So the local permitting department that issues the permit that you're seeking, you would say, here's my address. Can you issue me a letter? Or sometimes the landlord will already have one of those letters. Or if you're working with a company that sources real estate, like some of the companies that I work for and have worked with, they may already have that in place. But that does give you a greater measure of certainty.
There was actually one thing that you brought up in our pre-interview that I thought was rather interesting. There was a difference between as of right or a possible issuance in related to the zoning. Could you go into a little bit more detail on that?
Sure. So zoning tends to be a little gobbledygook of letters, and each place is going to have slightly different variations of what those letters mean. But there are permits you can get where if you check all the boxes, you're getting that permit. And then there are permits you can get where you could check all the boxes and there is still discretion about whether that permit is issued for that particular property. Sometimes that could be a political component. Sometimes you're subject to NIMBYs. Sometimes they just don't think it's a consistent use for other activities that are occurring. A ZP or a zoning permit often will allow for the use of a particular activity, whereas a CUP or conditional use permit means that it's conditional. You're not guaranteed that you're going to get that permit at that location.
Okay, cool. Those are good things to know. So before even talking about to a cannabis real estate professional, you can do some of your own due diligence in getting licensing and making sure that you're hunting in the right area for the right kind of property.
Yes, but.
I love the yes buts. yes buts will catch you a lot of money, don't they?
I would recommend only learning enough to know whether you're hiring a good consultant and whether they're doing a good job for you. Otherwise, you're going to spend a lot of time going down a lot of rabbit holes. You may be incredibly well-informed, but you may not be much further along.
Okay. Fair. So we got that. Zoning and setbacks. A lot of information on there. Don't go super deep, but be mindful of those things. What is the next consideration that you see a lot of cannabis operators have some issues with?
these businesses are expensive to stand up. And one of the most expensive and stress-producing periods is prior to these businesses being operational. They're pre-revenue. And so I see a lot of pre-licensing burn rates that could be minimized. The examples that I would offer, Brian, are there are many people who secure real estate without having total certainty about whether that location is going to work for them. So all of the things we talked about in terms of zoning and setbacks, that all needs to be done before somebody starts paying a landlord money or goes into escrow to acquire a building, in my opinion. There are some exceptions, but not many. So not insisting on total site-specific certainty before spending money is a way in which people often, it just costs them more. And then there are some strategies around securing real estate. You need to understand if you're in a market where you need real estate to apply for a permit or whether you apply for a permit and then you need to marry it to real estate. And both of those have issues. If you need real estate before you apply for a permit, then you have to actually pay to have some measure of site control over that property while you're in a permit pending status. And that permit pending status can take years. On the other hand, if you're in a municipality where you can apply for a permit. Once you get a permit, then you're looking for the appropriate site. By the time you're looking for an appropriate site, the boardwalks and the park places may already have been secured by your competition and you're stuck with Oriental Avenue.
I love the Monopoly analogy.
Yeah, like you don't
still make
a lot
of money on Baltic Avenue though.
No, you're not making money on Baltic. The purples and the light blues, no bueno. Yeah, you pass go, but so what? And so there's this constant challenge between spending too much to secure a site too soon versus if you don't secure a site soon enough, you could be radiused out by people who got better locations than you. And that's not as sustainable and as exciting as it could be. So there are different ways to secure property. One, for example, is to have a single fee that you pay somebody until you get your permit issued. And then that single fee, they're taking the ride with you in terms of the time and the uncertainty around how long it'll take until you know whether you're getting a permit or not. Another would be a stepped down or stepped up burn rate, meaning I'm going to give you X number of dollars today, and every month or every quarter that goes on, I'm going to give you slightly smaller or significantly smaller dollar amounts. Why? Because the longer it takes, the more I'm spending, the more consideration you're getting from me, and I don't even know if I have a business to run. The opposite is also true. You can say, hey, I'm going to give you just a little bit now, but the longer it takes, the more patient you need to be with me, the more money I'm going to give you. So stepped up are ways to save some capital. There's also some hacks. If you can find a location that has a month-to-month tenant in it, then the landlord is already receiving rents and you don't have to pay the landlord to keep that location vacant. Another hack is to find a location that's owner-occupied. A lot of people are graying out. A lot of people are thinking about retiring. There's a world in which you find an owner-occupied property and you're like, great, you're running your vacuum cleaner shop and that's working for you. And my permits could take a really long time. In the meantime, run your business, operate your going concerns. And if and when I get that permit, then I'm going to give you a bunch of money and I'm going to move in.
Mm-hmm. It's all about the art of the deal, right? The negotiations, being careful with these people, making sure that your ends are covered and theirs ends are covered as well.
And the art of the deal is an interesting paradigm because on the one hand, I think it's important to paint a measure of excitement without being a hype man. On the other hand, there's a lot of uncertainty and to be able to communicate that as a rationalization or justification for why you're not just spending money needlessly, it's a delicate conversation to have. It's even harder when you've never met the person, you can't go out for a dinner, you're 1,000 miles away from them. How do you build trust with people? Traditionally, real estate transactions are really toe-to-toe, belly-to-belly, face-to-face, and people are breaking bread or they're finding ways to have a personal connection. That's very difficult when you are halfway across the country.
Well, get on a plane, make it happen. Knock on the door, find out what they like, make sure you show up with it. So
I take notes. I like to know what kind of dog they have. What's the name of their dog? How many kids? If you can find a way to make a personal connection, the value of that is really hard to quantify.
I was actually just going to ask you that. I'm like, what is a good takeaway point of how to break down some of those barriers and really connect with these people? And especially like New York area, it is so tough to find properties that, because this is going to be an area of concentric circles that you are trying to navigate through here. If you find a property that works, yeah, finding out what their dog's name is definitely a help on that one.
I mean, look, I'm an acquired taste. I know I'm not for everybody, but I do my best every single day to be as authentic as possible because people smell a lack of authenticity quicker than anything else. And it can turn people off to something that would have otherwise been palatable for them and they might have said yes to. So I don't use scripts. I try to keep it real. If I'm having a good day, I share my wins. If I'm having a not so great day, I might even kvetch a little bit. But I want to be authentic all the time because I'm trying to build trust. And the only way to do that, in my opinion, is authenticity.
I like that. So take that for, okay. So mind out, be authentic, manage your pre-licensing burn rates. It'll cost you a lot of money if you do not. So there is that. The next one I thought was actually quite interesting. And I thought it was actually only for a certain subset of cannabis operators, but it's pretty wide. The third one, we're going to talk about utility needs. We can go back to our Monopoly example. We got Waterworks.
Waterworks, Electric Avenue. Those are good. And if you have both of them, you get even more when someone hits on them and you don't have to put any houses on those utility.
Double the rent. Yeah, no houses.
So yeah, I've been involved in a lot of land sales and I come up with these little mantras for myself, like no water, no value for land or things like that. And when it comes to acquiring or leasing real property for a cannabis business, I'm always thinking about what is the limiting factor. And there's always limiting factors. Identifying what those limiting factors are and ascertaining cost of cure and time to address those limiting factors is where I think people win or lose. And so when I think about utilities, I really want to understand the power and water needs of my load calculations based on the size and design. And it's not just for cultivation. And so if someone's like, oh, I've got a 100,000 square foot building. Great. A lot of square footage. How much power do you have? Oh, well, only enough to run 10,000 square feet of cultivation. Oh, but your design on your deck says you're going to run 50,000 square feet of cultivation triple tiered. Well, you don't have the electricity for that. And so if I think back in the lessons learned and the horror stories of where people have made mistakes, I think about desert hot springs where people got amazing cultivation permits, but the buildings that they acquired or leased and those burn rates, whether it was a mortgage or an investor or as a tenant, they had to wait for the electricity to be upgraded by the utility company offsite. And utility companies aren't known to move quick. I mean, maybe if you got a power outage in a bougie neighborhood, they'll help you get those power lines restored. But they're not upgrading a substation anytime soon. And so understanding the limiting factor on electricity is huge. And again, it's not just for cultivation. You've got extraction. You have to have robust HVAC. What about retail where you didn't calc in all the load for your security systems or electric locking doors? And so that goes to the load calc. If you don't have a load calculation based on all that you think you're going to use power-wise, you're probably going to get a coulda, woulda, shoulda, or you're going to saddle up to me and say, whoa, I learned a lot. Great, but at what cost? Could you have learned it a little quicker and a little less expensive? The other one that comes up for me is water. And a lot of companies, oh, I'm not doing cultivation. I don't need water. Yeah, but what about the fire sprinklers you're going to need to install in the ceilings? And let's just talk about water. What's the size of the water main going into the street? What's the diameter of that pipe?
So you have to like build like a water tower to be able to, you know, to fund all this stuff as a queue. Oh my God.
Yeah. So, you know, I think about fire sprinklers and required upgrades to a building. And what is the diameter of that pipe going out to the street? And what is the cost of that? And do you have to hire a company that has a special bond so they can do subterranean construction on a city-owned street? And what's the time associated with that? So water and power, critical elements to think about. It's not just the square footage. It's not just the parking. It's not just the location. And so all that matters at the end of the day is time and money, and figuring out what that's going to look like, and then adding a little bit into both of those so that if things go over budget or over time, you're not caught flat-footed. And so I think about the cost of some of those offsite improvements. And when I think about offsite improvements, I think about utilities upgrading on their end, or I think about the upgrades beyond the parcel limits when you're talking about upgrading water in the street. And so those are all things to think about ahead of time. And frankly, anybody who's caught flat-footed with that, that's a lack of experience is all that is. Those are avoidable missteps.
So really with that takeaway of that one is plan for maximum capacity and think upstream. Utility companies work really slow and possibly even slower for cannabis companies. So yeah, think upstream, be mindful, you know, plan out for the full picture on that one. Very smart move on that one.
And And with locations, always build not for what you think you're going to do, but build for more than you think you're going to do, because nobody wants to outgrow a location, whether they've signed a long-term lease or they've purchased real estate. Outgrowing a location, some people would frame that as, well, I was a victim of my own success. And that may be true, but you may also be a victim of short-term planning.
Yeah, yeah, that's very true. Yeah, because then you're just stuck waiting for all the stuff to catch up and you're stuck at a small facility on that. Speaking of facilities, let's talk about building needs.
Build for your future use, not your present or intended short-term use. Space, power, floor plans. Think about a new build out versus renovating. In a lot of markets, you can go into existing facilities and just upgrade the technology, the functionality, the flow. Not everything needs to be built to suit and build from scratch. And so that's an opportunity in 2024. You can find some existing cannabis businesses that have the appropriate licenses and maybe have some antiquated systems. Maybe they're doing extraction with a methodology that doesn't allow you for the level of productization or that you could create now with the use of hydrocarbons or volatile organic compounds. And so I always think there should be a new build out versus renovate mindset. The other thing about building means is, like, if you forgot to think about Americans with Disability Act, like, shame on you, because those are just typical commercial considerations. With the right team, the right advisors, the right consultants, those are all things that you should know ahead of time going in eyes wide open. The number of people who acquire a building without getting a certified access specialist report to understand what they're going to need to do to upgrade that building in terms of Americans with Disability Act requirements, whether that's painting the parking lot, handicap parking spaces, wider doors for the bathrooms. These are all known considerations. They're avoidable issues, cost you more on the front side, saves you a lot of heartburn and headache on the backside. I think about that. I also think about security design and the build out. And I think about that through a different lens than a lot of entrepreneurs and operators think about that through. Most people think, what am I required to do? Over regulation, they're requiring me to put a camera ever X number of this, X number of that. Your security system should not be based on what the government is telling you to do. Your security system should be based on not getting robbed. And we are seeing in mature markets loss that is substantial. And I don't care if you're insured, because insurance doesn't cover the headache. Insurance doesn't cover your time dealing with the insurance. Insurance may not even make you whole. So people need to be thinking about, what do they need to do to prevent against loss? And a lot of these markets, New Jersey, New York, they haven't even seen this wave yet, okay? There are going to be some professional thieves like Ocean's 11 that come through and clean out some really, really valuable inventory. When you think about how small a vape cartridge is and how valuable it is and how easily you could liquidate that on the secondary market, these are high-value products. And so thinking about security, and frankly, whatever that you're required to do for security, do more. It'll help you sleep at night. And so security, I think, is a huge thing. In terms of cultivation, I think of pre-operational contaminant testing. Test the walls. Is there lead-based paint? The beauty of regulated cannabis is the lab testing that gives us a supply chain that creates a very safe product for consumers. But if you go into a building and you haven't tested paint chips and you haven't tested the building materials and you grow your first crop and then you wonder why it didn't pass lab testing and all you did was use living soil and organic nutrients, it might be the building. Also, the other thing I think about in terms of building considerations for cultivation is right-sizing the drying and curing footprint to the cultivation footprint. The number of people who pay too much attention to the space being allocated towards production and cultivation without allocating enough space towards curing is terrible. The quality of cannabis is 50% the grow and 50% the cure if we're talking about flower. And so not having enough curing space, having to dry too quick, having things mold, not having it be dark enough, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Always think about your drying and curing. The other thing I think about is propagation space commensurate with vegetation and blooming space. So obviously, some places you're not allowed to make your own cuts, babies, propagate, starts, whatever you want to call it. But in other markets, you are. And if you're doing that, you're saving a lot of money by not buying those cuts from somebody with a nursery license. And so understanding your ratio of square footage for blooming, square footage for vegetation, and square footage for propagation. And having that be very well thought out is incredibly important. Some people bloom and veg in the same space, and there's nothing wrong with that. But these are not things to think about later. These are things.
Yeah, those are things to be mindful about well in advance of what our workflow is, because it's like you are moving through a calendar of grows, and it's taking away from that grow time if you don't have that separate room.
And propagation is one where a lot of people, they'll put in their deck that they're going to buy cuts at X number of dollars per cut. Well, what if you get a bunch of virus-infected cuts from a nursery? What if you actually have a place on site and your license allows you to take advantage of doing that on site? Less logistics, some leisure predictability. It's just things to consider as people allocate square footage. They should definitely be spending some time with a graph paper, understanding what they can do on site, and then figuring out how they optimize those operations for profitability.
Wouldn't hurt to hire somebody who's done it a few times before either, right?
Well, yes, but, and the yes, but is everybody's a master grower. Everybody is amazing at this. Everybody is amazing at that. Everybody's got a horror story about a consultant who oversold their capabilities and wasn't worth the money they received. And so it wouldn't hurt to hire a consultant if you do extreme due diligence on the consultants. And so you are only as good, not at the bravado of your consultant, not at the quality of their website, but at your ability to vet them before you give them money.
Yeah, and references of achievable goals that they've done this before.
If they can't give you validated results in some capacity, then thank them for their time and move on. Going back to building needs, let's talk about extraction. So are we talking about volatile versus non-volatile extraction? Are we going to need a C1, D1 explosion-proof facility? Is that something that we're bringing in, or is that something that we're building there? What about storage for biomass commensurate with the extraction machinery capabilities? You'll saddle up to some people and they'll be like, oh, my machine can go through this in a day. Great. Do you have the facilities on site to store the biomass? Most people pay too much attention to the throughput capacity or capabilities of their extraction equipment without thinking about where they're going to store that biomass and being able to efficiently look at that as a system. I also think about commercial kitchen considerations. A lot of people will get a manufacturing license and they will say that they're going to be open for making edibles. But what about the commercial kitchen? What about the gas and the HVAC to the roof for that? So thinking about those and not just putting it on graph paper. And then lastly, packaging and assembling, cages, HVAC, additional storage places. If you can make a lot of great products and you're going to package them yourself, you can't just do that in a teeny little closet and pack a few people in there.
I did operations in college, and it was all this, you know, operations management in college. It was all these solver things. If you're going through all these supply chains and there was like capacity constraints, how these things would get through there. And it sounds great to be able to move a bunch of product real quick, but like, you know, the whole supply chain needs to be in unison to be able to make that as a smart allocation method. And standing up like parallel processes, you can stand up more, but if you don't have a place to have the stuff ahead of time and the stuff after the fact, it's just going to sit there and it's going to clog up the works.
Your business will be subject to the weakest link in your design and planning when it comes to a supply chain. And cannabis is a supply chain business. And I think about all of the cultivators in Lake County who were able to get acres and acres of canopy, outdoor canopy permitted. And with the exception of Santa Barbara, Lake County is arguably one of the easiest places to get multi-acre cultivation permits in California. And a lot of these places were in the middle of Timbuktu. People didn't think about the curing and they didn't have facilities on site. So now they're moving wet weed, who knows how far, to be able to bring it to a secure location. And the companies that solved that problem and provided them offsite curing, storage, trimming, packaging, those companies in some ways had a better business, less CapEx, and they were solving a problem that was desperately needed by people who couldn't afford to mess around because they were going to lose their fruit on the vine.
Cool. Yeah, very, very mindful things. So be mindful of the full supply chain on that one. We got four down. We've got one last one to go here. If this is valuable to you guys, like I really appreciate you being on Yarrow. If you can give us a like, subscribe to this. Actually, any comments that you have for Yarrow, any questions on here, put them in the comments. We'd love to hear them, and I'll make sure. And actually, there's a follow-up episode you guys would love to hear. Please put that on the comments as well. I'd appreciate those. So that said, Yarrow, what is the last big decision in cannabis real estate?
Well, I think the last big decision in cannabis real estate is the big decision in real estate, which is buy versus lease. The pros of buying is that you have total control over that asset. No landlord authorizations for improvements. Your asset has a chance of appreciating. And there is appreciation based on the increased utility of the tenant improvements, the TIs and the fixtures, furniture, and equipment, or as we call them, FFEs. There's also payment certainty depending upon the type of debt or no debt that you might have on that real estate. There's also, and this is critical, expanded debt and capital options, often at a lower cost due to the collateralization options that come with real property that has a base utilitarian value. If somebody invests in your business and you have no assets, or somebody invests in your business and you have depreciating assets, you will not be able to access the type of capital you could access when you own real estate.
At the end of the day, it's a thing. It's a building. It's an asset. And it could be used to do other things with.
That's right. And the other thing is, much of the third-party due diligence work that you would do if you were acquiring a piece of real estate is not cannabis specific and can be used upon resale. So there's some recapture of that if and when you divest to that real estate. The con to buying is that you have a higher upfront capital requirements, either all cash or down payment. The entity that you're using to acquire that property would need to qualify for a purchase loan if you're getting a mortgage. It's harder to exit a location than it is to exit a lease. It's less liquidable. Did I say that right?
You got that one. Yeah, liquidable is a hard word.
It's got some consonants in there that remind me of a Greek menu, but it's higher and more time-consuming due diligence expenses than just a lease. Now, the pros of a lease are that a lease has less upfront capital requirements, less expensive to relocate, like we said, and lease terms still remain in place even if the property sells to a new landlord. It's also less expensive and less time-consuming pre-occupancy due diligence. Some of the things that you would have to consider as a buyer, if you're a tenant, that's the landlord's problem. The cons to leasing is that you typically see escalating payments over time. You have a lack of privacy from landlord or property management companies. You have triple nets often on your commercial leases, which means that the landlord's expenses are passed through to you, whether that's property management fees, insurance, property taxes, common space expenses, et cetera, et cetera. You have no choice about what companies would provide maintenance to the property. If the landlord wants to hire his cousin Al, who doesn't do a great job, you're stuck with that choice because it's not your choice. And lastly, there's more competition because of the lower capital requirements. So having capital can be an advantage because then you're not competing with companies that are trying to be tenants.
So there's pros and cons to each. And you know, this is a very capital constrained industry in 2024. Sometimes you don't really have a choice. You're going to have to find something to navigate, you know, these small concentric circles that seem to be getting smaller and smaller and smaller as you try to find property that works. This is like probably like the last big tentpole one of you, the last navigation thing that you have to do. It might not even be an option to you of like, we found a property. It is a lease. We found a property. It is for sale. We have to find $5 million now or whatever the situation is.
Well, and if you're a tenant, you can also negotiate a lease with an option to purchase. So there is a hybrid solution where you can go in as a tenant. And if you do well and you do right and you negotiate ahead of time, you can become your own landlord.
I like that. So I know we're at time now, but I want to leave the audience with a little bit of a bonus thing. It is, again, we're recording this in March 2024. What are some things that you're seeing as trends, you know, in real estate in the cannabis industry right now, Yarrow?
By the dip in more mature markets, there's an opportunity for those that can access capital or create a team that has access capital to buy the dip. So distressed assets in maturing markets provide operators in 2024 the ability to acquire a leasehold or fee simple location for a fraction of the dollars spent to build some of these locations and to acquire some of these entitlements. And for sales, many original purchasers did not do adequate physical due diligence, which means you can go in, do that physical due diligence, and beat up on them based on the findings and the additional cost it might take to correct some of those things. And many of the original tenants who were on a leasehold interest did not build in adequate extension options for landlords for leasehold agreements into their leases. So New markets, very different. But established or maturing markets, there's an opportunity now that didn't exist before, and people can acquire these locations for pennies on the dollar. And I do not think we should conflate that with those markets not being good medium and long-term opportunities for those that have the staying power, the capital, the expertise, the accountability, and an experienced team.
It could have just been a good operator that just ran out of runway. They didn't have enough time to get through there. So it could be a great building, could have checked all those boxes that we talked about today.
More wealth is created in a downturn than an upturn. And I learned that the hard way in the 2006-2007 real estate correction. And that upset me so much because I wasn't on the right side of the coin when that happened then. And so there's an opportunity now with cannabis assets. More wealth will be created in this downturn and correction in maturing markets. And those that figure out how to navigate that are going to be the biggest, most pronounced winners.
So if you have a laser-focused eye and good consultants and some good advice to roll through this, you can save yourself a lot of time and cut through bad things, bad opportunities or dead ends before spending too much time on them. So going through today, the top five, we got zoning and setbacks, pre-licensing burn rates, utility needs, building needs, and the big decision of buying versus leasing. And it's 2024, there might be some opportunities that are out there. So we fit as much information as we could in almost 30 minutes, but I know you have a wealth of more information on this. Yaro, if anyone is watching this today and just really wants to speak to you or connect with you, what is the best ways that they can do that?
Besides Carrier Pigeon or Good Vibes, they can find me on LinkedIn, Yaro Lee Kubrin. They can find me on Instagram, Yaro Lee Kubrin. I'm not hard to reach. I'm not hard to find.
See you on High at Nine. And you have your own podcast. You have your own podcast coming out.
I got some stuff in the works that isn't fully public facing yet. We're going to do some content with Zoned Properties that is really exciting. And I think there's a world in which we're also going to do something with Castle Security and Nine Point Strategies, which is a security and insurance company. I talked about those three legs of the three boring legs of the stool that matters and that most people don't appreciate. That boring stuff's pretty darn important. And I think that we are going to do a good job of helping people to educate themselves so they can avoid the things that are avoidable.
The boring triad. I'm glad your presentation, a lot of this was really interesting though, because it's a lot and it's very expensive if you get it wrong. And I don't think that's boring at all. I think it's actually quite entertaining. So Yaro, thanks for being a guest on the show today. We really appreciate it. And like I said, if you guys found any value in today's show, give it a like, subscribe, and leave some things in the comments. I'm happy to have Yaro come back, and we can do a deep dive in real dispensaries. We can do a deep dive in cultivation, or some of the other boring triads that we have to talk about as well. So, Yaro, thanks for being on here. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Brian, and thank you, Flourish.